Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the American South. I'm your host, Brandon Jett. On today's podcast, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Bronwyn Boyd, an interdisciplinary scholar whose experience growing up in Jackson, Mississippi during the Civil Rights Movement and its aftermath inspired her to study, teach, and write about the U.S. South. She holds a B.A. in Journalism, Broadcasting, and Film from Trinity University, an M.A. in Southern Studies from the University of Mississippi, and a Ph.D. in American Studies from the University of Texas. She has served on the faculties of Vanderbilt University, the University of Mississippi, and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and as a postdoctoral fellow at Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities, and as a visiting fellow at the Humanities Research Center and at Australian National University. She is also the past president of the Kentucky-Tennessee American Studies Association and the Chesapeake American Studies Association. Today, she's here to speak with me about her recent book, Southern Beauty, Race, Ritual, and Memory in the Modern South, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2022. The book focuses on three popular gender rituals, sorority rush, beauty pageants, and the Confederate pageant of the Natchez, Mississippi pilgrimage. With its focus on performance, Southern Beauty moves beyond representations to show how femininity in motion, stylized and predictable but ephemeral, has succeeded as an enduring emblem where other symbols faltered by failing to draw scrutiny. Continuing to make the moves of region and race, even as many Confederate symbols have been retired, the Southern Beauty has persisted, maintaining power and privilege through consistent performance. Elizabeth Boyd, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
I think a good place to start this conversation about the book is with the title. This is something I learned in grad school very early on. The first book we read, I remember the professor told me or asked me some question, like what I thought about the book or something. And I was kind of fumbling through it. And he's like, the best place to start is always with the title. Like, why did the author pick this thing? Because obviously we all think about that quite a bit. So the title, Southern Beauty. What exactly is the Southern Beauty, and where did this idea, or perhaps more appropriately, this ideal emerge?
Well, so I think about the Southern Beauty as the legacy figure of the Southern Lady and the Southern Belle that I argue have been sort of fused in the contemporary imagination into this Southern Beauty. But she really came from antebellum times, and she was sort of an ideal cooked up by white slaveholding men to control their households of, you know, women and children and slaves. The Southern lady was, you know, over time she was the lady on the pedestal. She was really much more a myth than anything else, and she was used to justify everything from slavery to Jim Crow to lynching. And so she was, you know, over time she was this symbol of the region of the White South, and is both motif and rationale. You know, she's the reason for our Southern segregated way of life.
Is the Southern beauty something that was created by the kind of patriarchal society that existed, or is this something that kind of emerged from women themselves? Does that question make sense? Like, is this something that's kind of thrust upon them, or is this something that they are kind of generating on their own, or is it some combination of the two?
Well, white Southerners were early on producing region through these different performances, trying to, you know, casting these, they had aristocratic pretensions. So anything that they could sort of gesture towards their connection to European nobility, you know, was all the better. And so they did things like 12th night parties and historical pageants and fencing bouts, you know, in the 19th century, and May Day pageants were very big. And historical pageants grew out of this trend. And all of these productions featured the, you know, virginal white woman, usually at a tender age, being held up as this symbol of their civilization. So there was always a white woman at the center of these productions. And over time, these grew into more public performances as the, for instance, the many of these productions after the Civil War were produced by the United Daughters of the Confederacy at Confederate reunions and monument unveilings. They would always have white children, and everyone would be dressed in white, and there would be sort of a queen-like person held up as this symbol of the civilization lost. So it was very much a lost cause thing. And I look at how when those Confederate veterans, when the last one finally dies off, that impetus, that sentiment has to go somewhere. And what happens is, you know, that's around 1920. And in 1921 is when the Miss America pageant starts. And so there's this shift from the ideal woman, the Southern beauty, being on a pedestal, to moving to pageantry of all sorts: parades, pageants, competitions, historical pageantry, tableau. But so she moves. It was really a pretty easy shift. And my book, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about this, but also looks at how that happened and why the Southern states became so prominent and successful within beauty pageant competitions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. What I really like this book, and I talked to you about this off air, is that it's kind of outside of the typical kind of historical book that I would look at. I study like criminal justice and crime and violence and things like that. And so I'm always excited to read something like fresh and new that maybe wouldn't have come into my bookshelf otherwise. But you know, when you look at criminal justice in the Jim Crow South, you engage with topics like lynchings, and there you see a kind of idealized woman also at the kind of center,
who's at risk of supposedly bestial black men, which was also another big figment. I mean, it was all cooked up by white patriarchal men, justifying their control of the entire society.
Yeah. And it was just really, I don't know if nice is the right word, but it provided me with a little bit more context as like, this wasn't just like an 1890 to 1920 phenomenon. This is something that has been perpetuated, you know, since the antebellum period up into today. Let's maybe get into some of these rituals a little bit, because that's really the fulcrum around which the book unfolds. So as I mentioned in the introduction, you focus on three popular rituals, and these are things that I'm assuming many listeners will be familiar with, at least maybe one or two of them. And this is sorority rush on universities and college campuses, beauty pageants, both at the kind of national level, but also at the very localized level. And then you have the Confederate pageant, and you look at this in Natchez, Mississippi in particular. And as I suggested, well, maybe most people or some people know about some of these, just to make sure everybody's on the same page. Could you maybe just briefly explain what each of these three rituals are?
Of course. And I did choose the three in part because they are so familiar to white Southerners, and many young women have participated in one or more of these rituals. So sorority rush, which is now called recruitment, but I believe that everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say sorority rush, is the method by which new members are selected for these exclusive private Greek letter organizations on college campuses. I refer to it as a feminine stratification ritual, where, you know, the groups with the most, the best reputation and the most popularity and the most money and the most everything, the best GPAs, they seek to find new members who will contribute positively to continuing that trend. And through them, of course, the big social magnet is the ability to attract these girls like a magnet, and then through them, the right fraternity men are delivered. So that's sorority rush. And then beauty pageants, perhaps more familiarly, what exactly are they? They're competitions with very very stringent and sort of in their own bubble aesthetic, to which the competitors must attempt to, you know, hit the exactly right mark in all of these different segments of competition, and they largely grew out of harvest pageant, harvest festivals and things like that, but became more homogenized and sort of structured, especially through the Miss America pageant, which is the one that I look at the most closely and is considered sort of the gold standard and producer of this ideal American symbol.
Yeah. And probably the one that most listeners are most familiar with would be that big grandiose Miss America pageant, you know, that is on TV and all that stuff. But you look at them from that level, state level, college level, all the way down to, you know, small town like LaPel, where I'm from, which is really, really
right.
Cool.
And all the businesses that are around them and grow out of them.
Right.
That generate.
And some kind of clandestine, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I just really love to, like, there is a whole business behind these pageants and, you know, getting the right dress made by the right person. And you kind of have to know someone who knows someone who knows someone to go to these small towns and, you know, Alabama somewhere. And there's this fantastic and storied dressmaker who like gets
that's
people
right. Who has
to
a runway
really cool.
in her living room.
Right. I thought that was really, really funny and just really, really interesting. Something I wouldn't have really thought about previously. So anyway, sorry.
Right. No. And then the Confederate pageant of the Natchez Pilgrimage. The Natchez Pilgrimage, of course, is a home and garden tour of an astounding collection of antebellum homes in Natchez, Mississippi. And for 82 years, the garden clubs of Natchez put on a tourist production that was hosted during the weeks of pilgrimage, called the Confederate Pageant, and it was a series of tableau with music and participation by hundreds of volunteers every year from the local community, everyone from age 3 on up, performing these different roles. And it was very much a Moonlight and Magnolias version of Natchez, and by extension, Southern history, in which there's no depiction of enslavement whatsoever. And this production actually is a production on two levels, one for the tourist audience, and I argue the other audience is each other, because a lot of status accrues from performing certain roles in this pageant, with the mothers of the Garden Club having their dedicated work over the years rewarded in the end by having their children selected to be in the court, or highest of all, queen of the Natchez pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Does that give you an idea of what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the Natchez pilgrimage would probably be the most unfamiliar one to most listeners.
So but if you've ever been to... This is a production that is auxiliary to the actual tour of homes.
Yeah, and I mean, if you've ever been to Natchez, you could probably envision kind of what this looks like. I was taken to Natchez by my grandparents that lived in New Orleans when I was really young, and even then, I think I was in like fifth grade or something, and we didn't see the pageant or anything, but it's just that tour of homes. And I remember even like a fifth grade kid who was brought up in like the South, in the early 90s. I just remember thinking, what about the slaves, right? And I just remember very distinctly one of the tour guides, you know, she was going on and on about the mantle in this house and, you know, this plantation home, and it was a gorgeous mantle. But, you know, that's when I said it. I was like, yeah, like, what about the enslaved people? And I just remember her response was, they got new clothes at Christmas and were treated very well. And then like next, that's where we're going. And I think when I was reading that portion of the book, I don't know much about that pageant, but I was just kind of like, yeah, this seems to kind of fit in with what I perceive and remember Natchez to be. I'll say this. I liked learning a little bit more about Sorority Rush. I went to a college as an undergrad that didn't have a very robust Greek system. And so I knew a couple of people who were in fraternities and sororities, but it wasn't quite this grandiose production that you described. But it wasn't until I got to my PhD program that was a big, flagship state institution in the South, that I was really exposed to what Rush looked like. I obviously wasn't participating in it, but, some students were involved in it, and you could just kind of see it on campus. And I was like, what in the world? I mean, it is an institution kind of within this institution. But it was something that was a little foreign to me. I didn't really know all that went into it. And so I really, really appreciated that kind of level of scrutiny and kind of an insider look into what goes on in
Sorority
Rush.
Yeah, so in each chapter that deals with these rituals, I go behind the scenes and also base my analysis in part on a series of taped interviews that I did.
So let's talk a little bit about that. You described your research approach as, and I love this, necessarily eclectic. And you said it was designed to illuminate wide-ranging but related questions from multiple vantage points. So what was this research process like for you, and what kind of sources did you rely on?
Well, let me back up just a second, Brandon, because I have to tell you how I got interested in researching this in the first place. I had been living in Texas. I did grow up in Mississippi, as your introduction noted, but I had been away for a few years, and I came back to work on my master's in Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi. And I was just sort of hit by this wall of competitive femininity. It was everywhere. And I kept thinking, whoa, I mean, I had grown up with this, but it was really something to see. And I saw so much of it being there at sort of ground zero of Southern beauty culture at the University of Mississippi. And so the other thing that was going on was that scholars were starting to investigate the idea of whiteness, and especially of Southern identity as coded as white. And I kept thinking, how could that be? That's so absurd on its face. The South has always been at least biracial or even multiracial, and we have always lived in close proximity together. And so I started thinking, well, if Southern identity is coded white, what does femininity have to do with it? What are maybe these rituals? Because I started asking myself, what's going on here? As you said, it's so bizarre when you see some of these things going on campus. I thought there must be something else more significant going on than just picking new members, you know, in that case, or in a beauty pageant. Why are people so invested in being in a beauty pageant? And why is their whole town rallying around them? Right? And the Natchez interest came a bit later, but debutante balls, which the Confederate pageant, that's a key element I should have mentioned, functions as something as a debutante ball for that town. I thought there must be something. Why is it so intense? And what does gender performance have to do with it? Because I just had a suspicion that it they were related. And so I really didn't at first know what it was that I was interested in finding out. And I decided I wanted to do some taped interviews with participants in these rituals to find out their perspective. I mean, I was very aware that, and the rest of the method is more ethnographic observation, as well as, of course, lots of secondary research. But I was very aware that I could have come up with one analysis based on just watching these performances, but that would not really tell me what these participants' investment was, what was their motivation, what did they say the competition was about? And that's one of the questions I asked them. You know, why is it so precise? Why is it so high stakes? What's going on here? And so I would not have been able to write the book that I did without actually going behind the scenes and also interviewing these girls.
Yeah. So just to kind of get in your headspace a little bit, I remember when I was at the undergrad institution, you know, there were a couple of people who were rushing. And I remember I asked one of my not good friends from high school, but, you know, we knew each other and we went to the same college after that. And it was like the first week of rush or something like that. And I remember she was outside of the dorms and I walked up and I was like, hey, you know, what's going on? And she's like, kind of
can't talk to you.
Suggesting to me that she couldn't talk to me. And I was like, oh. I'm so sorry, right? And then like a week later, she was like, hey, sorry, but you know, the rules of Rush are that we can't speak to, I don't know if it's any guy or like what the rule was, but they didn't want anybody's decision to be tainted by like outside influence. And then there were all these weird things like you picked your top three or four, and then the sororities picked their, like if you match your top with their top, then it works. And if it didn't, then like you're out. And I was like, oh my gosh, it seems so cutthroat. And it didn't really make much sense to me. So I wonder, a little bit. And so I wonder this idea and you think, okay, this is interesting. Did you just walk up to sorority rushies and say, hey, what's going on here?
Well, you know, that's the thing. You don't just drop by a sorority rush party. You have to have permission. And the same thing, actually, with all of the things that I studied, with the Natchez pilgrimage, especially being closely held, if you will. And so there, I did have to have permission in advance. And I know that I benefited from being a white Southerner. I was a Mississippian. I was a local girl. And I probably did research, that they probably would not let me do now. Like actually going to these rush parties. Because you know, Rush. And I did it at the University of Mississippi and the University of Alabama.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. And so, you know, Bama Rush has become this phenom with TikTok, which happened after I did the research for my book, but I have some thoughts about that. And I had to have permission of Greek life. and then permission from the young women themselves. But I have to say that, and I went to some chapter meetings and said, because I had a friend in the history department who said, well, you know, Beth, what students understand is a sign-up sheet. So you sign them up. So I went to the chapter meeting. Yes, it worked.
Not only did it work,
but you know, people referred their friends, and it was a snowball effect. And so
they weren't suspicious at all. Like, okay, what? Why do you want to know about these things?
All of my interviews, people had the choice to be anonymous in publication, and some of them did choose that. And of course, I did releases, informed consent. Based on typical folklore paperwork. And, you know, they were there of their own volition. They wanted to talk to me. And I know at the University of Alabama, some of the administrators, I got wind of that they weren't too thrilled with the girls coming and talking to me, that it was okay if I came and watched the parties. But
that seems like it would be the worst part.
Yeah. But they came anyway. And I set up at archives on both campuses at the University of Mississippi. The Blues Archives let me have free reign of having a room. And it was right across the street from Sorority Row. So that was awesome. And so I had no problem getting people to tell me their personal perspective.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was really fascinating because I was just struck by that one story where when my first attempt to try to understand Rush, and it was like, no, we're not allowed to talk. And I was just really impressed with the amount of information that you were able to gather from these participants in something that is kind of secretive, right? Like that's part of the appeal to it is, you know, those who know, you know, the appropriate dress and how you're supposed to comport yourself tend to do better in these Rush activities and in these pageants and, you know, in terms of placement in the Confederate pageant that you talked about. So I just found that really fascinating that it is supposed to be kind of guarded, but yet you were able to get such access.
Each of these rituals, there's a public and a private side. And it's kind of funny to me because Sorority Rush makes a big deal about certain things being private, you know, their ritual, quote unquote. And yet lots of people who join a different club go through the houses. They have to go through the process. So many of them have seen it, but there are things that you can only see from being in the house. And I have to say that was super interesting to watch the rushing going on and to go in the one room and it'd be all the legacies in that room and how they were being rushed differently from the girls in a different room and how just different things that were the mechanics of actually conducting Rush, because they have to choose each other. In reality, the sororities have the upper hand, unless you're like the number one it girl on campus that everyone wants. And they have to do it extremely efficiently because the parties are pretty short. There are hundreds of girls going through this series of three or four parties in the space of a week. So it by necessity has to be pretty superficial. But they also, as my book details, there's a lot of advanced planning and research and finding out about who's going to be coming through the door before Russia even starts.
And that seemed to be a pretty consistent theme throughout the three rituals is, you know, you've got the public facing side of it, right? Where, you know, right. So if you take like the beauty pageants, for instance, right? Okay, well, you've got some young ladies who are interested in this and then they go, you know, work on a talent and then they get a dress and, you know, then they go up on stage. I've never seen one, but then, you know, I'm like assuming this is what happens, right? And then the crowd votes and they pick and then there's a winner and everybody's happy. But it's the behind the scenes stuff.
The crowd doesn't vote. The judges vote.
Yeah, like select judges, right? And it's like, who you know, you know, who sponsored you, what businesses have supported you, who made your dress, what your family connections, like, it's just all this behind the scenes aspect of it that
right,
that I found pretty consistent in all of
watching.
Them.
That's exactly right. And in the quote unquote strong states of beauty pageant competition, with Mississippi being number one,
right,
because of its track record, there's just more competition and more tendency on the part of the pageant officials to make the contestants compete repeatedly for several years before they will advance them to the next level of competition. So they're not going to choose Miss Mississippi, you know, like this Cinderella narrative that she can just show up with her borrowed gown and et cetera and win. It's pretty much a given that it's going to be somebody who is a seasoned pageant contender and probably a seasoned contender in that pageant.
Yeah, like these are all really difficult things to break into. I have a daughter, and you know, as I was reading that, I was like, if I don't know anything about Rush or beauty pageants, right? And if she said, I'm interested in this, like my idea would kind of be that Cinderella story, right? It's just like, okay, well, we'll go find a dress, I guess, and then we'll show up to the thing. And he's like, that is not going to be the most effective route.
Right. Then if you get to a competitive campus like these SEC schools that I depict, if you did that, you would then find yourself competing with girls that have been prepping and preparing for Rush since the beginning of high school,
right?
Because
right.
there's such a what's the word I'm looking for? A pipeline from certain schools. There are certain schools and certain towns that are favored over others, and girls are protecting their reputations in particular in advance, in case the sorority girls, where they want to pledge, hear about something off color that could really hurt their chances.
Yeah. So the book is about more than just, hey, let's talk about this ritual here. And isn't this kind of an interesting insight into these things you maybe don't know too much about? But you say there's actually something much more going on here. And you argue that these young women, be it the sorority rushees or the pageant contestants or the people who are taking part in the Natchez Confederate pageant, that they've been charged with the task of what you call constructing region and linking this duty to annual gender rituals crucial to social success. And so I was hoping you could maybe delve in a little bit into this idea of these rituals in some way, shape, or form constructing region, right? Like, what does that mean and how do these rituals accomplish that?
Well, you know, all regions are constructed, you know, and you do it by trafficking in difference, you know, sort of convincing ourselves over and over that there really is something distinctive about the South in this case. And it can come from traditions and customs and retail items. But it's also to do with these performances that every year, like clockwork, allow the Southern beauty to serve as this really central memory mechanism for nostalgic white Southerners who want to see themselves as connected to an earlier South, and often that is a South, a segregated South in which they had privilege and So the Southern beauty is this central and really effective performer. She's a symbol, but her symbol is made relevant by repeat performance. So you there are things that have to be these annual traditions, and often they have to do with pageantry. I mentioned some of the early ones. You know, the early sort of European aristocratic assertions of May Days and fencing bouts and historical pageants. But in the mid-20th century South, on college campuses, when you have massive resistance to desegregation and to racial equality, the Southern Beauty is like, that's her heyday. She is held up as this symbol of the white South. And I talk about her as basically being a form of passive resistance to changing the South's racial ways. That is the quiet, silent, lovely counterpart to that ugly, violent, to use your word, masculine, massive resistance. And so she is continually held up in these productions. And if you look at the mid-20th century South, on college campuses in particular, there's a beauty pageant practically every week. And I talk about some of those in the book. But there are also other productions. For instance, during football season, there would be, of course, homecoming queens and other types of queens. But part and parcel of this was demonstrating the difference between this beautiful white symbol of region and the blackness that she is not, right? So there's lots of blackface in campus productions, both in performative, fraternity and sorority parties, even in Sorority Rush. So people that think about blackface being something that dudes did or do, no. There are young women in blackface at sorority parties, and it's part of showing, how hilarious, right? Showing the stark difference of their race and class privilege. And there's no better shorthand way to do it than blackface. And it's this incredibly pervasive at college campuses, not strictly in the South, but certainly in the South.
Okay, so help me make this connection here, because like in my mind, I have some friends and they bought me a Southern manners guide or something that they found at some like antique shop or something from the 19th century at some point, right? And we're kind of reading through it, and sometimes I bring it to class and we like joke about, these are the expected behaviors, right? And I think in many ways they are kind of constructing or reinforcing this Southern beauty ideal. So help me make this connection between, you've got this kind of paternalistic pressure in the 19th century that is kind of concocting this image based off of, old European standards and the Southern standards at the time, designed to like perpetuate patriarchy and like racial privilege, right? How does that connect to, some small town, the Strawberry Harvest Festival queen? How are those two things connected, and how is the Strawberry Queen pageant? And I don't know if that exists, so please don't get upset, Strawberry Queen pageant, if you're out there. But what is the connection between those two, and how does this perpetuate that ideal that was crafted, a century and a half ago?
Well, so the Strawberry Queen, of which there are many,
and I'm sure they're all wonderful,
right? That's a good example, because these harvest festival queens, they grew out of the need for instance, I don't know about strawberries, but to use cotton or tobacco as a larger crop example, to sort of literally draw interest in people to come in and purchase at these festivals and fairs the excess yields, all right? And so these harvest queens, and they were very saucy and a little racy looking. Some of their posters and calendars that they were on were quite provocative. They would be caressing the crops, or
this tobacco
leaf. You
would
never see it now, right? But of course, what's not depicted, and the queens are all white, is the means of production, there's no mention of the African-American and white tenant farmers who actually produce the crop. So there's this, again, this sort of silencing and not looking at the entire picture here, but still holding up this white woman as an ideal. Now, you also asked about, and I'm not sure I totally addressed this, but about why these coming of age rituals are important to producing region. And that has to do with it as well, because coming of age rituals, you know, they're all these within a certain period of your lifespan. It's just a few, it's a narrow window. And with these being sort of entry points for social success and status, the fact that they happen every year like clockwork means that they continually they reproduce the system because every year there's a new group of girls whose mother or whomever wants them to participate in this, and they've been expecting to do this. For some people going through sorority rush, they've been expecting to do this their entire life, right? Even the beauty pageant queens have a window from about, I'm thinking about at the state level. Of course, there are many junior kids pageants, but those are, you know, they age out at, I think, age 23, maybe. So it is a coming of age experience. And with these methods of accruing and status and privilege attached to them.
Absolutely. So you kind of teased this a little bit, but maybe we could engage with it a little bit more fully. This is a book about the South, so race is kind of at the center of all of it, and your subtitle certainly suggests that. So how does race fit into these regional constructions that are being perpetuated, you know, year after year after year after year? You kind of mentioned, you know, like the queens for a very long time are always white. But let's take like the Natchez pilgrimage or the Confederate pilgrimage, for example. Like what is it that is going on in that pageant, and how does it grapple with the issue of race, or does it grapple with the issue of race at all?
Well, the story that Natchez wants to tell about its past remains unresolved. As I said, for 82 years, they performed a pretty consistent script that did not discuss enslavement at all. The early years of the pageant actually had some African-American citizens on stage, but they were doing pretty demeaning things like picking cotton and, eating watermelon and et cetera. And when the 60s rolled around, they, you know, pretty much collectively withdrew from participating in that sort of role.
The African American participants.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, understandably, and but over the years, there's the production changed somewhat with each vignette, with some vignettes being taken out and others being put in. But the general story was one of a happy, benevolent antebellum South. Even in more recent years, when they had a few African American participants, for instance, singing on stage, it didn't really change the cultural logic of the production. Now, a few years ago, there was a radical break. There was a young woman who was asked to be queen, and she was a history major at Millsaps College. And she said, it was Madeline Isles, and her father's a novelist. And she said, "Daddy, unless you rewrite the script, I am not doing this." And so he did. And they had quite a different script there for a couple of years where enslavement was depicted. It was discussed. And at the end, it's amazing that this is different, but, you know, it was recognized that the South had lost. And it was quite different. Yeah. And then a subsequent production kept some of those changes, but it was a little bit different, but also in a more progressive vein. And then ultimately, one of the clubs withdrew, citing artistic differences. And the remaining club has gone back to producing a pageant that's more like the original than these more recent renditions. I have not seen the most recent pageant because my, you know, my book ends at a certain point. But to me, it's nice to see Natchez grappling with its past. What happened was for so many years and decades, when other communities around the country were redrafting or doing away with some of these sort of nostalgic productions, they kept on and really didn't change it for a long time. They didn't see anything wrong with it. And then even after they realized that there was, they were sort of painting themselves into a representational corner, they couldn't figure out how to change it. And the big sticking point was that to change it, they would be doing away with this Confederate court scene at the end, which served as the debutante function for the queen and her court. So it became this issue of presentation, as in debutante presentation. And so, you know, it's a question, again, of linking a particular locale's story with this demonstration of class privilege and reproducing the Natchez social structure that unfortunately were linked, and they couldn't figure out a way to unhook them.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we're thinking about this, like, okay, maybe in the 1960s or something, right? You've got like segregated schools and colleges and but like surely, right? Like over time, colleges are integrating, sororities, I'm assuming are integrating these beauty pageants at the local level, a state and national level. They're not just all white contestants anymore. So in terms of like presentation, how does it continue to perpetuate this kind of idealized notion of Southern beauty, but also this kind of racialized understanding of both region and kind of feminine ideals, despite some of the like more progressive changes we've undergone in this country in the last, 50, 60 years in terms of like integrating both Black and white people into these formerly segregated institutions?
Well, so the change that has come has been with all deliberate speed. And I do mean deliberate. I mean, sororities did not desegregate at the University of Alabama until I believe it was 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's shocking.
That's only 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, and this is a pattern. I mean, I mentioned Natchez because it's sort of a concentrated case study, if you will. But they're not the only ones. This is a question that goes on at questions about tourist productions across the South. And sororities have now nominally desegregated. Beauty pageants probably were ahead of either the other two. But as I argue in the book, the sort of cultural logic and parameters of the beauty pageant still managed to produce a lot of conformity, no matter what your complexion is, in from the contestants, so that you may have this young African-American contestant who's outbells the other young women, right? And so it's not as much, there's a little bit of a color correction with a few, in some cases, token members of these productions. But there has not been anything, for instance, I don't think that mainline sororities will ever approximate the demographics of their states, for example.
Yeah. And right? Even if you think through, like, you know, you have to have that background knowledge. And if these institutions have been segregated until 10 years ago, if you are a young Black woman and you are trying to rush, you don't have that institutional knowledge or those backgrounds or those connections that many of your white counterparts would.
You don't have those recommendation letters, and you don't have the legacy status.
Right.
And so that's helpful for you to have the legacy status.
Right.
That's exactly right.
I found that quite interesting. You know, when we have conversations about policing, right, it's kind of similar in a lot of ways where the introduction of Black police officers was supposed to be something that, like, radically changed policing in a way that was more equitable. And in some ways, you know, policing has obviously changed and improved, but in other ways, we find that police officers, regardless of their ethnic or racial background, kind of adopt the culture of police, right? And don't necessarily radically adjust it, but more kind of conform to the pre-existing culture that exists there. And I think I saw a connection between what you were arguing in your book and kind of what we talk about when we think about policing.
Yes. You know, I think there's a tipping point beyond which these institutions will not diversify, because that's not the point of exclusion, right? If you're trying to be up your reputation on campus or whatever through joining a particular club or becoming a certain beauty pageant or being queen of the pilgrimage, you're not going to get there. You're inherently playing by the rules of an exclusionary system.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you know, we've had this reckoning of sorts over the last, you know, five years. Especially concerning some of these Confederate monuments and, you know, parks and schools and streets named after Confederate generals and whatnot. And you know, we've seen monuments come down and schools be renamed. But it seems like these rituals that you bring up have incredible staying power. And so what do you think it is about these rituals, Rush, the pageants that have kind of, I mean, people scrutinize them for sure, and some people criticize them, but not to the point that, you know, people are you know, doing away with them completely. So what do you think it is about these rituals that you identified that allows them to kind of continue to perpetuate this kind of Southern beauty ideal and kind of reaffirm this notion of, you know, a white South in ways that other things that did a similar thing have kind of been pushed aside? What is it with the staying power?
Well, think about what is a symbol. A symbol promotes all sorts of ideas and emotions and connotations to adhere to it and to be this shorthand for meaning, right? And the Southern beauty has now outlasted the Confederate flag and the monuments. And I think, you know, but she, I think she is this, has been this incredibly effective, powerful memory mechanism and source of nostalgia, this sort of focal point for people wanting to sort of see themselves as in continuity with an earlier, more pleasant, more privileged space in the white South. So it's a white nostalgia argument. But I think that she's been able to last as long as she has because she's sort of a stealth operator, which is funny because she's so out there and in public and in your face and so visual. But it's people wanting to consume her You know, they're so sentimental about this figure. And she's escaped notice because she's also not been discussed. There's two things here, right? First of all, she's a woman. And how important could that possibly be? Right? How could, you know, this is just frivolity and leisure activities and campus rituals, and we've always done it this way. And Brandon, it's tradition. So, and you know what that means. Well, so there's been a lot of silence about her cultural work. She has been highly successful at suggesting and gesturing as, you know, this figure of continuity with an earlier South, because the audience is complicit. They want, you know, they give her so much social reinforcement and recognition and all the status goodies that she wants for performing this rendition of White Southern Womanhood. So she gets a lot out of it. But it's also this silence that surrounds her.
Yeah. And, right? You know, I was kind of thinking too, it's so familiar, right? Like, you've seen the beauty pageants forever. You know, people who are in sororities and I think sometimes it's that like, well, I know Elizabeth and she was in a sorority and she's a nice person. Surely they're not, you know, she's not perpetuating some racialized fictitious notion of the South. She's just a nice person. And she wanted to join this like social group or, you know, be in this pageant. That's really great. And she does a lot of community service. So I could like totally see how the familiarity allows the ideal of the Southern beauty to kind of fend off some of those criticisms.
That's just it. We as a culture have normalized this, and to the fact that we don't think it's odd when someone shows up in class in a hoop skirt.
Right.
So, you know, on its face, that's kind of bizarre. But yes, and I talk about, you know, the young women going through Rush, being able to sort of turn on a dime and pull this Southern lady performance out of their back pocket when they need it. This is not to say that they fashion themselves like this day in and day out. That's not what's important. What's important is being able to do it when it matters. And but it has totally been normalized, and so she carries on.
She carries on. Well, I always like to ask authors this last question. So this will be the one that sends us off here. After someone closes this book, they've read it from cover to cover, they close it. What do you hope they take away from all of this?
Well, I hope they problematize these productions, right? Especially the young white Southern women who have the power to change them by either continuing to go along to get along and participate, or by realizing and refusing to participate. I hope that in essence, young white Southern women will see and recognize the goldfish bowl. You know, that if this is the water in which they swim that has become so normalized that they now recognize the real work that these productions do right up until this day. Ostensibly, they receive a lot of privilege, race and class privilege, but it's at the expense of gender deference. And, you know, is that a privilege or is that a trap? Yes, there are rewards, but what kind of rewards are they? And what are the costs for all of us? So, yeah. That's what I would hope.
I think that's really great too, because I think, you know, for so long, the issue of Confederate monuments, just it was just kind of that right there. We would go to New Orleans all the time, and it's Lee Circle. There's a statue of Robert E. Lee. It's just kind of what it is, right? And I don't think it was until there was like a real kind of emphasis on, no, like, this is what the Confederacy was. This is why this monument was put up when it was put up. And this is the kind of thing that it reinforces. That we saw this kind of slow movement, but eventually it picked up enough steam that people, you know, like, yeah, I think we have to do away with this, because it, even though it's been normalized and maybe we don't necessarily think about it all the time, it is reinforcing this notion. It has been for decades.
And normalized, so maybe, by white people.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
And of course, I talk about that in the book, how the murders in Charleston at Emmanuel AME Church really caused a reckoning and a moment when white Southerners finally had to look at themselves in the mirror and recognize what the Civil War had really been about. And for, as historians, that's sort of flabbergasting. But, you know, there was this, again, this silence for so many decades, where people just didn't want to think about it because they didn't want to feel bad. And now we see that happening with school curricula.
Yeah.
Right.
Among other things. I'm in Florida. We know all about it.
I know. And with things like the pageant at Natchez.
Yeah.
Right. Because it calls into question what you had always understood about your family and local history, if that's how you learned it, if you learned your understanding of the past from these sort of family tales and local myths, then having to recognize something radically different can be extremely painful.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it's an excellent way, this book, an excellent way to further that conversation and hopefully be part of this eventual reckoning where people can at least those who are participants in these things recognize that, you know, the images and the rituals and the consistency and the timing can in fact have really negative consequences both for participants and the rest of us writ large. So I think it's a fantastic book. Again, it just engages with stuff that are both familiar but somewhat foreign in a way that is revealing, but also just takes that extra step and kind of forces us to grapple with this, like, yeah, but what's really behind all of this and how is it impacting society, you know, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, but even right up to this very day. So congratulations on such a fantastic work. And just to remind our listeners, the book is Southern Beauty, Race, Ritual, and Memory in the Modern South, and it is published by the University of Georgia Press. Elizabeth Boyd, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to New Books in the American South.